1460 WVOX.
Whitney Media 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates on WVOX-AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound. It can also be heard live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. One can call directly to the station at 914-636-0110. But please stay germane to our topic. My guest this morning is author Alan First. Our discussion is about his writings, which describe the dark days in Europe during the period right before World War II, along with the early years of its conflict. Each story involves the average and not-so-average Europeans who are caught up in the intrigue, spying, espionage, and resistance against the Nazis. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. To that end, many of our shows are devoted to that purpose. Today, we'll divert a bit to the common culture, the world of intrigue and espionage that so many millions of Americans are interested in. Welcome, Alan First, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Richard.
My pleasure. Alan First was born and raised in Manhattan. He received a B.A. from Oberlin College in 1962 and an M.A. from Penn State in 1967. He lived in the south of France as a Fulbright teaching fellow at the Faculté des Lettres at the University of Montpelier. Then in Seattle, where he worked for the City of Seattle Arts Commission, he wrote for magazines, travel pieces, and book reviews for Esquire, wrote and published four novels. He returned to France. He lived in Paris, wrote a weekly column for the International Herald Tribune, and wrote his first historical novel, Night Soldiers, in 1988. This was followed by Dark Star, The Polish Officer, The World at Night, Red Gold, Kingdom of Shadows, Blood of Victory, Dark Voyage, The Foreign Correspondent, Spies of the Warsaw, and most recently, the very interesting and intriguing Spies of the Balkans. I've had the pleasure of reading a number of these books. His novels have been translated into 17 languages. In 2002, he was actually featured in an advertisement for Absolute Vodka, which he wrote the copy in the style of his novels. You know, Alan, it was written in a published review that your reluctant heroes are not fists and whiskey gumshoes of hard-nosed Marine sergeants surrounded by old money, Pernod, and creamy-skinned women. They are men of means and education who are thrust into action by German aggression and forced to deal with the consequences. In reading your books, one is reminded of the film noir movies of the post-World War II era, which featured anti-heroic characters played by Humphrey Bogart, Robert Mitchum, Orson Welles, Glenn Ford, and others. Many of these films were based on books by James Cain, Dashiell Hammett, and Raymond Chandler. As a child of that era and a native New Yorker who grew up in the city when many of those films were popular, were you influenced by that genre or style? And did you read any of the novels that these films were based upon?
Honestly, I didn't. I was not interested in that as a kid very much. Of course, I saw those movies later. But I would have to say that the real influences on me, and they were much, much later in my 30s, really, the most influential work of all was Eric Ambler, Coffin for Demetrius. I recommend that to your listeners. It is the most incredibly prescient book. I mean, it was written in 1938, and I think came out in 39, and it sort of lays out everything that I was to go on and write about. It's also extremely entertaining. And it was a sort of a fair, not-so-great movie. But I was influenced by Eric Ambler. I was certainly influenced by Graham Greene. And I was influenced in general by the British writers. Le Carré, of course, in the way that they approached this period of time. They were a lot closer to it than Americans. And when Americans were busy writing noir novels about Los Angeles, which I certainly read, but they didn't, I mean, I read them for pleasure. I got pleasure from them. And I think maybe they had something to do with my becoming a genre writer later on.
Mm. You know, it's sort of interesting as you bring that up, because the British really were way ahead of us in terms of Secret Service and the famed Secretary of State and then later Secretary of War under FDR. Henry L. Stimson made that famous quote, "Gentlemen, don't read other men's mails." You know,
that's right.
And that was sort of, even though we did have a kind of department dealing with spying, but that sort of was the attitude of Americans, you know, isolationist to, you know, to large oceans. You know, of course, our audience knows your novels do not take place in the mean streets and the dark alleys of post-World War II America, but in the pre-early World War II era of Europe and places that stretch from the Black Sea to northwestern Greece, to the oil fields of Ploesti, the dank ports from Marseille to the Baltic, and the cafes of Paris to the drawing rooms in Warsaw. Your novels are famous for detail, their understanding of the times, and they take place in and even the accuracy of the street corners where they take place. My question, therefore, is why such attention to detail? And were you ever affected by some of the nitpicker, you know, the nitpicker critics who found an error here and there or an arcane inconsistency?
Well, I'm affected, yes, of course, because in some instances, I changed things. For example, I always get letters from Brits, never Americans, but always from Brits concerning bomber choice in 1939.
Right.
The Wellington came, you know, wasn't flying until 2 months later. And
right.
I feel, you know, these people were on the very sharp edge. They almost lost. They really came close, believe me. Now, Churchill said this was a close-run thing. Well, it was worse than that, because they had very dark days there when it looked like Hitler was going to win the war in the air, which would have meant the German troops were in Belgium and Holland, in the ports, ready to go. That particular story, Operation Sea Lion, is told in a book called The Polish Officer, again in great detail. I think detail for me locates the reader. It's what I like in books. I want to see what stores there were, what the weather was like, what the street felt like, to try to bring back that day itself. Now, I will say that there have been some nitpickers. I got a letter once from a German gentleman who said a train that I had pulling into Ulm in 1938 didn't come in there at 9:20. It came at 10:15. What was the matter with me?
Should have done your research.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's interesting, and you bring that up, and it's so fascinating because I'm interested in the subject, and I would breeze by something like that. It wouldn't affect me in the least. But I think your remarks about the greater intensity of the British, you know, we're separate, as Churchill said, we're two people separated by a common language. You know, in a sense that you're right. I mean, the war was very edgy, and we over here in the United States have a tendency to think, oh yes, you know, it was inevitable, a victory. And obviously it wasn't inevitable, and it was very difficult. Another sort of a corollary to what you just said, after you make, you know, you're informed of these things, over the years, I know, obviously you get things, do you kick yourself or do you say, you know, hey, turn the page, as they say?
Yeah, no, I say turn the page. One of the things you learn as a novelist is the usefulness of police interrogation. Because the fact of the matter is, you can't make up a story and get everything right.
Mm.
If you tell the truth, you can. But if you try to make up a story, you're always going to get things wrong.
Right.
It's just inevitable. In a novel-length work, you will get things wrong.
Mm.
But I try as hard as I can not to, especially the kinds of things that jerk readers' heads up. And they go, oh, no, wait a minute, that couldn't have happened then. You know, you didn't have direct dialing to foreign places that year. I mean, those are big things. And I work very hard to try to get my technology right. For a book called Dark Star, I had to do seagoing freighter technology for 1940. It was really hard. I didn't know anything about it. I had to learn it from the bottom up. And you should have seen the stuff I was reading.
Really. I can imagine, you know, as an early... in my early life reading novels, I was always impressed by, and of course he didn't go into the detail in the same way you did, but how Ernest Hemingway went to the venue where authors before lived it, whether it was F. Scott Fitzgerald living in Hollywood or Broadway writing about the beautiful people, you know, the Roaring Twenties, and others living in Faulkner, living in Mississippi. Everybody wrote about where they were. Nathaniel Hawthorne here in Hemington goes to places, you know, and that's the difference. Maybe he was the first to really do that. We have to go to a short financial news update in a second or so. I've been talking to my guest author, Alan First, and our discussion is focusing on his writings about Europe during the period right before World War II, along with the early years of its conflict regarding the average European who's caught up in the intrigue and resistance. We'll be back and focusing more on this in a moment or so.
Business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour. Here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD2.
From the Fox Business Network, stocks are sliding as concerns linger about Europe's ability to lift itself out of its debt crisis. At noon Eastern, the Dow is slipping 47 points. Oil, meanwhile, is surging more than $2, topping $101 a barrel. U.S. homebuilders are feeling a little more upbeat about the U.S. housing market. The National Association of Homebuilders says its builder sentiment index rose to 20 in November, the highest level since May 2010. There is a fresh indication that retail inflation may have peaked in the spring. The Labor Department says the consumer price index dropped 0.1% in October. And the nation's industrial production rose in October at the fastest rate in 3 months. Today's report from the Federal Reserve says factories made more trucks, electronics, and business equipment, a sign that manufacturing is recovering after slowing this spring. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Sandra Smith.
Can't believe I'm pulling this off after all these years. So glad I got that personal loan from OneMain Financial.
Can I take this blindfold off?
Let me help you.
We're going on a cruise.
No, dear. The honeymoon we never took.
You've made promises, we can help you keep them. We are OneMain Financial, providing personalized loan solutions with flexible payment options. Go to OneMainFinancial.com or call 1-855-321-MAIN. OneMain Financial, your needs, your goals, your dreams. Offer subject to restrictions and requirements of a licensee. For licensing information, visit our website or call us.
Call us crazy.
You're crazy.
But we believe radio should be delivered free of charge.
Are you crazy?
Go ahead, listen all you want. It's free. WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD2.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates. My guest, novelist Alan First, who focuses on the lives, loves, and struggles in Europe during the period right before World War II, along with the early years of the conflict, and these people that are caught up in the intrigue, espionage, and resistance. Alan, many of your principal characters are individuals of means. Some are minor officials of the government, police officers, the landed gentry, film producers, military officers, and even sea captains. Many take on different identities, work for the underground, indulge in espionage, and are spies. Is there a common thread that exists within your heroes who are mostly men?
Those are the people, Richard, who did it. When you read the history of the period, and I have read it for 20 years continually, it's again and again the same vocations turn out to be useful to people who are struggling against something like the Nazi regime. Mm. So those are the people that you just named. Those characters were chosen by vocation, and the vocation was chosen by reading history and seeing who really did that.
Right.
That said, I should add something that maybe you haven't heard or maybe your listeners haven't heard. I happened upon something, a study that they did after the war, where they questioned hundreds and hundreds of French people who had been involved in the lines that got pilots out of Europe into Spain and back to London. And all these people were asked, why did you do this? And by far, the greatest number answered, because I was asked, which is something I never, ever would have come up with. But I think everybody in an occupied country is disposed to fight against the occupier unless you're a collaborator. But people don't know what to do. You don't go out of your house one morning and say, I want to start resistance.
Right.
For another thing, it was extremely dangerous. A lot of those people died. You really, really are signing your death warrant. What is that? There's a famous quote from the 16th or 17th century in Britain. He who raises his sword against his sovereign can throw away the scabbard.
Right.
You know, you
very good.
That. Yeah, no, it's terrific. And I think it's really true. It's serious business. But people were willing to do it. People are very brave and very compassionate when they're called upon to be.
Right. And that's very interesting, because one of the questions I would have asked was it survival, defiance, the cause of freedom, anti-totalitarianism, or just being the wrong place at the wrong time and being forced into patriotism? I think you hit the nail on the head. Many are called, but few are chosen. So in a sense that you're right. How do you turn? Where do you turn to find the Free French of the Interior, the Maquis? You know, everybody, if you're inquiring it, they think you're a double agent or a traitor. So it's an interesting aspect as you brought it up. You know, your novels exist in the harsh reality, all too real conditions facing citizens throughout Europe. They mostly take place in the period right before the breakout of the war, in the desperate early days of the continental occupation by the Nazis, and the local bred fascists in Spain, Bulgaria, Hungary, and other locales. But in each novel, you often focus on a specific effort. One of your protagonists in The Blood of Victory, the Russian emigre, I.A. Serebin, is recruited by the British Secret Service to stop the importing of Romanian oil to Germany from the Ploiesti oil fields. Alan, how important was Romanian oil to the German war machine? And could you tell us a bit how it was protected?
There would have been no war if that oil had been stopped. That's how important it was. Germany could synthesize from coal enough oil for the Luftwaffe, for the Air Force. That's it. So if they couldn't have gotten the Romanian oil, they would have had an Air Force and horses and mules hauling carts on the ground, which they had plenty of anyhow.
Right. In fact, most of the artillery into Poland was drawn by horse.
Yes, it sure was. Plus the fact that they didn't. The reason for the Blitzkrieg is it used less gas.
Right.
Well, it's true. I mean, they just didn't have enough oil, enough fuel to run the size army that they needed to run in order to fight a country like Russia.
Right.
Somebody points out somewhere, for again the same reason, that the drivers of trucks, who were farm boys who'd never seen a truck before, German I'm talking about.
Right.
They got something like 10 hours of truck driving practice. And this caused absolute hell when they attacked in Russia. These people were turning the trucks over. They were going too fast, too slow. They were getting stuck. The trucks were breaking down. That was a very important factor in the war. Meanwhile, Americans were terrific. Shade tree mechanics, you know, they'd open the hood, go in there with a pliers and a screwdriver and voila, the truck started.
Yeah, probably in 1939, we had most of the world's cars.
We did.
And, you know, it's funny, I have to bring a note to this. My late friend, the great Bay Bacalar, flew an A-20 Boston bomber from North Africa and also from Bari, Italy, to bomb the Ploiesti oil fields. And they were supposedly the most defended place in the history of the world. And the old story was they always passed by the first oil fields, which were the American Amoco. They were after the war. The Americans wanted to protect their property. I don't know whether that's true or not.
What is true is that the great raid against Ploiesti, which was a horrible, costly failure, was apparently betrayed. The Germans knew they were coming.
Yeah.
Bad thing. So they had planes, they had guns, they were waiting for the bombers.
Sure. You know, Napoleon once famously stated that an army marches on its stomach, but in World War II, oil, again, was the lifeblood of mechanized warfare. Were any of these resistance groups, especially who you were talking about, really effective with regards to interrupting the supply of oil?
Marginally so. I will tell you one interesting thing. The title of the book you're talking about is Blood of Victory, which in my practice sounds like a generic spy title, but it isn't. It's taken from a speech by a French senator made in 1918 at a petroleum conference when he said, oil, the blood of the earth, has become, in time of war, the blood of victory.
Very interesting. You know, it's before we go to a break, I just want to make this statement to our audience that there was more oil used in the Second World War than the whole history of the world before, and that the 20 years after. So oil was very, very critically important to the mechanized armies that broke away from the trench warfare of the First World War. We have to go to a commercial break in a second or so, and you're listening to The Advocates on WVOX Radio 1460 AM, live streaming at WVOX.com with my guest, author Alan First. And our discussion is focusing on his writings about World War II-era Europe and the intrigue, espionage, and resistance to the occupation and the individuals that were involved with it. We'll be back in a moment or so. Thanks.
And national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio. I'm Ron Flatter. For the first time since July, the price of crude oil has reached $100 a barrel. Analysts say this isn't so much a case of supply and demand as it is being unable to get at the supply. An explanation?
The reversal of a pipeline which used to take oil from the Gulf Coast for the refineries to refine and send to the Midwest. The problem is we've been getting a lot more oil than the refiners could refine, so the supplies got backlogged.
Fox Business Network contributor Phil Flynn in Chicago. Also today, consumer prices dropped slightly last month on Wall Street. The Dow is down 67 points. East Carolina University has been locked down after a gunman was seen on the street that runs through campus.
I don't see any people. I have seen a police officer once in a while.
Kathy Pruitt works in ECU's psychology department. The campus alert was issued a little more than 2 hours ago. Fox News. We report. You decide.
Our community programs are brought to you today by Young and Bartlett, Westchester's leading law firm for negligence, personal injury cases, and medical malpractice. Relying on 55 years of legal experience, partner Francis X. Young and his legendary father before him have been great advocates, recovering millions of dollars for those unfortunate individuals who were injured in any way, including victims of medical malpractice, construction job site accidents, motor vehicle accidents, or defective products. Young and Bartlett are actual trial attorneys who stand right up for you and your rights in the courtroom. Partner Mayo Bartlett of this top-notch firm also specializes in civil rights cases and criminal defense. Calling on his many years as assistant DA under famed crime fighters Carl Vergari and Janine Pirro. Today, Young and Bartlett is at 81 Main Street in White Plains at Lexington, two blocks from Metro North. Attorneys Frank Young and Mayo Bartlett. Two great lawyers, two dedicated advocates. Check them out at young-bartlett.com or by calling 914-285-1500.
First Generation Rock and Roll, the show that has the music that started it all. Doo-wop, where the legendary superstars of rock and roll live on. With his Sunday morning doo-wop oldies music radio show. The one, the only, Dennis Dion Nardone. Doo-wop oldies music radio show only on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com.
You can't go wrong with Dennis Dion Nardone.
Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather is brought to you on WVOX Worldwide by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center, right for New York.
Forecast Westchester County in the vicinity for this afternoon. Overcast skies will continue periods of rain through the afternoon hours. Highs will climb into the upper 50s. Occasional rain this evening. Overnight lows falling back into the middle 40s. Mostly cloudy. Occasional showers early Thursday, then partly sunny in the afternoon. Highs into the upper 40s, mostly clear. Windy and cold at night, lows dropping close to 30, mostly sunny. Upper 40s for highs on Friday. Sunny skies back into the 50s on Saturday, could reach 60. Overcast skies on Sunday. I'm Steve Pelletieri, Jr. reporting for WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD.
Every day, New Yorkers depend upon the clean and reliable electricity provided by Indian Point. On an average day, Indian Point provides about a quarter of the electricity for New York City and Westchester at lower cost than other power plants and helps our efforts to improve air quality. You have a right to know the facts about Indian Point, because when talk turns to extending the licenses of these plants, we all need to remember how important Indian Point is to New York. For instance, did you know that without Indian Point's lower cost power, our electric rates would be much higher, and that an equivalent gas-fired power plant would pour millions of tons of pollutants a year into the air we breathe, and that the independent experts in charge of New York's electric grid have said that the city could face rolling blackouts without Indian Point? I'm Teresa Motko, and I'm an engineer here at Indian Point, and my family and I live in the area. All of us have a right to know why Indian Point is right for New York. Visit rightfornewyork.com for answers.
We have special rates for independent producers on WVOX Worldwide.
Well, I think that's a U.S. code violation, Section 616, subparagraph 5A.
Reach the entire metro area on WVOX.com.
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
Your voice, your music. Call David O'Shaughnessy, 914-636-1460.
1460 WVOX.
Back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates and my guest, Alan First, on WVOX Radio, of course, 1460 AM, live streaming on WVOX.com. Our discussion is focusing on his writings about Europe during World War II era, along with the netherworld of spies, espionage, and active resistance. Alan, one of your most interesting stories was the voyage of the Santa Rosa from the Tagus River to Lisbon to Malmo in Sweden. The ship undergoes different disguises, different flags, and a cargo of desperate refugees and secret equipment. Was this story based on a specific incident during the war or an amalgam of various clandestine voyages?
An amalgam. All the targets, though, are as stated. In other words, the British Office of Naval Intelligence had things that they were after up in the Baltic, because it is, it does abut Germany,
sure.
And that's where Germany was exercising its new submarines. And by the time that submarine was out in the water for a couple of days, the Brits knew the names of all the crew, the number of the submarine, the name of it, who the captain was, et cetera, et cetera.
That's fascinating. That alone is fascinating. I mean, that's really amazing. Most of your stories take place in the most desperate days of the war, and it involves a sampling of some millions of refugees that were constantly running from German occupation. You touch on now and again the exquisite desperation of Jewish refugees who were not running from occupation, but imprisonment and potential death. Were you ever personally familiar with some of these refugees who came to America? Did they share any of their stories with you?
I was familiar with some of them. I had a summer job when I was in high school. Working for a pool company in Brooklyn. They made those plastic wading pools that go in people's backyards. Well, it was quite a mix of workers in that factory. The man who started it was Jewish, and he had fled to Argentina and didn't get into the United States until the early 50s. But when he got here in the early 50s, he hired people from Auschwitz. There were people in that factory with numbers on their arms. Now, you did not ask them questions. I mean, you just didn't, because so many people, maybe it's different now, but in those days, even a lot of the World War II vets, when they came back to the United States, didn't want to talk about it.
That's so true. I have the same experience.
Too horrible.
Yeah, I have the same exact experience. I had a person work with me who was a refugee who had tattoos. I agree with you 100%. Very interesting. So in all of your 11 Night Soldier novels, only French film director Jean Casson is a primary character of two books. But there are many crossover secondary characters like Ilya Goldman, Colonel Anton Weiberg, Count Janos Polanyi. Do these secondary characters serve as a common thread or linkage that you wanted to run through most of your books?
Oh, absolutely. This is a series, but it doesn't have the same lead character. So these people pop up, a kind of like the spy population of Europe as it was in 38, 39, 40. So you have some diplomats and you have some operatives of the British Secret Service. And I do continue stories, minor stories, from one book to the next. Lady Angela Hope, the British, terrible British spy, reappears now and then. And then there are kinds of other stories where there are people who follow these books very closely, and it's of interest to them, I think. For example, there's a book called Dark Star, where a tramp freighter brings a spy into Ostend on the coast of Belgium.
And I was there. What a beautiful town.
Yeah, incredible, right?
Yes.
The same freighter is destroyed in the following book, the Polish officer, when it has a cargo of naphtha and is docked in Cannes Harbor on the northern coast of France.
Well, it's interesting, and that allows the follower of your books, the ones to, sort of enjoy the continuity and see what happened to these characters as they move forward. The reader is somewhat curious all the time, I think. Do you have any favorites among these individuals? And as a corollary, Casson reminds me of the famous French actor Jean Gabin. Was he a model for that, for Casson?
No. The French film producer known clandestinely as Gilbert or Reynaud, who was very, very involved with de Gaulle and the French resistance, he returned to France after the occupation to organize resistance. So he's kind of a real character in this way, although his story is not exactly like the story of Renault, which went on for the whole war.
Yeah.
But I like, I don't know, it's hard to say. I like D'Amelia, who's the geographer, the Polish, on the Polish general staff. He's a geographer, head of the geography department. I like him. That's the Polish officer. I like the guy in Kingdom of Shadows, the Hungarian former cavalry officer who runs an advertising agency in Paris. And I like the policeman in Spies of the Balkans.
Right. Oh, he's
a terrific. I always wanted to do a cop. I finally got to do a really good one.
That's a terrific book. Your latest is really outstanding. I loved it. You know, it's interesting, and just to bring, sort of make a connection here, you know, you lived in France. You've spent plenty of time there. How's their feeling towards all this collaboration, the Admiral Darlan, the Pétain, these former heroes?
They have never, ever, ever gotten over it. It remains. Those old hostilities live on sometimes into the next generation. People have property that other people used to own that was never gotten back. Don't go losing a war. I really recommend against it, because then horrible things happen and you live with it for generations. When I returned to France to live full time, where I think it was 10 years, where I was living in France, I thought, what happened to these people? What's wrong? Because you began to get the sense that something was wrong. And what it really was is they never really recovered as a culture from the war, from the denunciations, from the people who collaborated, from the people who were murdered for collaborating. 100,000 people died in a kind of a civil war that followed the truce of 44.
And you know, a lot of people don't realize that there were tremendous amount of fascist sympathizers, even in Holland, who the Germans practically starved in the late part of the war. There were German, there were Dutch Nazis, there were Italians who served in the Wehrmacht. There were French. There were obviously Dutch. There were Norwegians. It's very interesting about how the refugees, the espionage, had to deal with so many different forces that were bought and sold by this parrot, and not because of only money. They believed in it.
Well, yes and no. I think a lot of the foreign nationals joined up for reasons of being opportunists.
Mm.
One of the things about an occupation is it brings out the worst people in the culture,
yeah.
The worst criminals who live to take advantage of a situation like that, and who then, and this was true in Paris, who then join the enemy and work for the enemy. It doesn't occur to them that those people are going to be kicked the hell out someday, and that then it's going to be time, you know, for them to get their comeuppance.
Yeah, we have to go to commercial. Quick question, 10-second answer. Women seem to be tertiary figures coming in and out of your protagonist's love life. Was this unintentional or intentional or what? Quick answer.
The quick answer is difficult. There's a lot of strong women in these books. Mm. I can say that. That's as much as I can say. They're all over the place. The only they're not the lead character.
Right. You know, we have to go to a commercial break. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 with my guest, Alan First. A discussion is focusing on his writings in Europe during the period right before World War II, early years of the conflict, regarding the average European caught up in intrigue and resistance. His latest book, which has had rave reviews, is great, is Spies of the Balkans. We'll be back in a moment or so in our concluding session with Alan First. Thank you.
World and national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. Occupy protesters in New York have lost their tents and tarps, but members of the movement say they're going ahead with a rally tomorrow.
They'll start at about 7 a.m., breakfast over at the New York Stock Exchange. They'll be joined with labor union protesters, and then they're going to begin marching north.
Fox Business Network's Adam Shapiro. On the West Coast, some Occupy movements seeming to pull together.
Last night, Occupy Oaklanders, who were removed from their tent camp at City Hall, joined students here at UC Berkeley and applauded as they set up tents on campus.
When you bail banks out, or when you continually have a history of big corporations running the world and changing the laws because they pay politicians to do it, that's a serious problem.
Today, they're in San Francisco to march on local banks and the state building.
Fox Radio's Jessica Rosenthal. Meanwhile, stocks occupying the red on Wall Street in midday trading as oil tops $100 a barrel. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Today's public affairs and issue-oriented community programs are brought to you by the Westchester Law Firm of Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss. This highly regarded regional firm handles matrimonial law and difficult family issues like separation, divorce, alimony, custody, and reconciliation, and is widely known for the caring personal interest and compassion its highly skilled attorneys bring to this most sensitive area of the law. Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, located in the heart of downtown White Plains in the Clarence Rapelier Building at 123 Main Street. The firm is led to this day by managing partner Henry Berman, a former chairman of the family law section of the prestigious New York State Bar Association. For a confidential consultation about matrimonial matters and family law issues, you're invited to call Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, a professional corporation of highly qualified lawyers handling matrimonial law in White Plains at 123 Main Street, 914-997-7100. The Westchester law firm with the statewide reputation, Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, 914-997-7100.
There's a beautiful young lady at WVOX radio station. Her name is Lacey. She happens to be a cockapoo, and she's kind of WVOX's mascot. But Lacey really belongs to our Bill O'Shaughnessy. And like Mary Had a Little Lamb, everywhere that Bill O'Shaughnessy goes, his dog is sure to follow. So naturally, we see a lot of Lacey, and we love her. And because we love her so much, we want her to feel as free as a bird, or as a dog in her case. Like all dogs, she needs space to run and have fun and investigate the land around her, but she has to learn her boundaries in order to be safe. Luckily, we discovered Dog Watch by PetWorks. What a fabulous hidden fence company this is. It's great for Lacey, and it's peace of mind for Bill and for all of us. The professionals at Dog Watch Pet Fences will easily do the installation. Please understand that this system is not an electric dog fence because the buried wire is not electrified. It's a form of fencing which uses a radio signal, and your dog will wear a special collar that detects the signal. In other words, they are radio fences, not electric fences. This is why, if you're a dog lover, I'm suggesting you call Dog Watch by PetWorks. Through an easy training process, your dog will learn to stay within the area blocked out. And for more information, call Dog Watch by PetWorks at 914-666-4480. Lacey has never looked happier, and I know you'd want the same for your dog. Call Dog Watch by PetWorks today, 914-666-4480.
Tune in to Jazz Plus with Greg Thomas, Sunday at 4 p.m., right here on WVOX. Expect iconic jazz masters and new recordings from the best jazz artists of today on Jazz Plus with Greg Thomas, here, Sundays at 4 p.m.
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of Stephen Mayo, Dr. Walter Lippow, Susan and Art Zuckerman, and the Soundshore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
We're always just a click away.
This internet is so darn easy.
Anytime, anywhere.
On my computer.
Streaming live at WVOX.com.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Thank you and welcome back to the Advocates and WVOX Radio, 1460 AM, live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest is author Alan First, his latest book. It's been out a little while. Spies of the Balkans is terrific. It's been reviewed tremendously. I'll give it my own review. It's excellent. I'm sure you'd all enjoy it. We've been discussing the early years of World War II regarding the average European caught up in the intrigue and resistance. Alan, your books are known again for meticulous regard for accuracy in painting a very vivid word picture of that horrendous era. Without revealing any trade secret, was it just hard work in verifying each locale? Or did you have to explore these haunts and seek out old maps and municipal records, how they really looked? I know you always mention these sections of Paris.
Well, I do. I have maps of the period, for sure, so that I don't get a street in Paris named after a resistance hero, that you don't want your resistance writer walking down an avenue named for a resistance hero. So you have to watch it.
Yeah, that's true.
But in general, I lived in Europe for 10 years, and by osmosis, I became partly European, I suppose, because I began to understand what those places are. So it isn't that I've been in every village, but I know what a European village is, in Romania or Belgium, and I know what a town is, and I know what a city is. It could be Paris, it could be Brussels, it could be all kinds of things, but they work in quite similar ways, and especially then, in the late 30s, they worked that way. So I have a good sense of place. Now, in order to do Spies of the Balkans, I had to go to Salonika because I had no idea what that was like. So I did go there. I do go places sometimes.
And that was, and Salonika was a very important concentration of Jewish people, Greeks who lived in Jewish, that was, you know, virtually destroyed by the
Nazis. It was known as the Jerusalem of the Balkans.
Yeah.
And for a long time, the majority of citizens in Salonika were Sephardic Jews who come from Spain in 1492.
Right. You know, this is an extremely sad and desperate and brutal time for millions of people throughout Europe. In a sense, it was almost like a new Dark Ages. Were you emotionally affected by the lives of your characters in that they reflected the struggles of real people?
It's very, very hard not to be. And I think of it, I think any historical novelist, not just me, takes a lot of hits when you do your research. Not only that, I never put horrible things in books. I spare the reader So I basically, when I come to something that's just too ugly to write about, and believe me, it's there, I just absorb it and go on. And I'm writing entertainment novels. I'm not trying to alter people or teach them anything. I'm writing books that are good for planes. I'm writing books that are good for your bedside table.
Right, and it gives you an idea of the world they were inhibited and were part of. You know, the 20th century, with all of its advances in communications, technology, machinery, education, even culture, was the most brutal and bloody of any time historically in recorded history, including the Crusades, the Hundred Years' War, the Age of Rome. Did we learn something from the state-sponsored genocide, the Holocaust, the ethnic cleansing, or are we doomed to repeat this type of conflagration in the future?
I'm afraid we're doomed to have the instinct, but I believe that the world is growing better at stopping it. It's almost like we're learning the worst about ourselves and then learning how to deal with the worst about ourselves, but it's very slow. I was living in Paris when the war in Yugoslavia broke out, and my reaction was, oh no, it's the old European virus. It's back again, and they're fighting again. I was just amazed, considering the nightmare that that country had during the war, that they wanted to take out the guns and go back at it again.
Well, I've always felt that on May 8th of 1945, the official VE Day, it actually happened the day before. They didn't want to announce it because it was leaked to one of the reporters. But this VE Day is a very important day, it seems to me, because it seems to have ended almost, I would say, 300 years of European civil wars modern era.
It for the time being, it certainly has. Let's hope that lasts. Nowadays, the weapons are so fearsome. All kinds, not just nuclear. The weapons are so fearsome, I think people have figured out that they better not start fooling around with this stuff again, because so many people are going to get hurt. They don't want any more cities wiped out. They don't want to lose churches and cathedrals or whole cultures, as is what happened to the Jews in Europe. So we're trying to progress, obviously. It's very slow. But I will tell you, the League of Nations failed. When they started the United Nations, I think went right after the war, people laughed. But it's not funny anymore. The United Nations is a real thing. It does some good things. It does some bad things. But it's an attempt to make things better. That's true with the euro as well. I don't know what's going to happen to that. Progress doesn't go in a straight line. Everything is a sine wave.
Yeah, no question. And, of course, the UN had its basis in the four freedoms of FDR's January 6th State of the Union Address in 1941 that transferred into the Great Atlantic Charter, Roosevelt and Churchill meeting in Argentia Bay. In a sense, I think the world looks at the four freedoms Atlantic Charter as more of a model. Hopefully it does. You know, as we're running down in time and in closing, I want to thank you, of course, Alan, for joining me today. Before we close, and we only have a few seconds left, will we see any of your heroes pop up in future works, or will the trend continue with new faces to worry about?
There'll always be a new hero, because one of the exciting and interesting things about an entertainment novel is getting to know the lead character over the course of the book. You can't do that a second time. So I don't repeat the lead characters, but I do repeat minor characters.
Okay. And is there an unlimited venue for this? Is it endless, the scope and the breadth of World War II? Is this something that people can tell stories about for generations into the future?
Well, seems like it, doesn't it? I mean, turn on the television. We fight that war every night, and every night we win.
That's right. On the History Channel, History International, the Military Channel.
Yeah, so people are incredibly drawn to this period because there was a very, very real difference between good and evil and very real heroism. It wasn't anything else but heroism.
You know, Professor Michael Curtis has been on this program a few times, an expert on the Middle East and North Africa and Islam, and fantastic. And he told me recently when he heard you were on that you were a student of his at Oberlin.
I was, that's right.
And that's great when you hear from your audience that way, who knows the guest. Was there something in this in your background with a terrific professor like Michael Curtis that interested you in history? In other words, how did you come about being so intrigued by Europe?
I'm really not entirely sure. It was certainly true that at Oberlin there was a professor like Michael Curtis who was European in origin. And I got at Oberlin for the first time to see that thing that was known as a European intellectual. And I was fascinated by that. Here were these people I never even knew about. And they were live, and they had things to say, and the kinds of things they had to say, the way they looked at the world was very, very different than what I'd known, which is, I suppose, what they call education.
Right? Well, you know what they say about New Yorkers? They're the most provincial people in the world. You know, they have, it's like the old New Yorker cartoon, where you look across the Hudson River. I mean, I've heard that from
New York.
Right, I know. It's a cliche, of course, but it's interesting how people think that way. Thank you, Alan, for joining me today. It was a great show.
Thank you, Richard. I enjoyed it.
My pleasure. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access that on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where the information my guests will be posted. You can listen to the shows. They're available. Next week, I'll be discussing JFK and public policy 50 years after his inauguration, almost to the day, 48 years to his death on 11/23, with Professor Garrison Nelson of the University of Vermont. In coming days, we'll be talking about the myths of Pearl Harbor with one of the leading experts in the world, Donald Goldstein, who with Professor Gordon Prang wrote in Dawn We Sleep. At Dawn We Sleep, pardon me. Have a great day, and thank you again, Alan, first for joining me. Thank you. Bye-bye.